Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. And welcome back to Scholarly Communication, this special series on the New Books Network that's about how knowledge gets known. I'm Daniel Shea, host of the series. Today we'll be talking to Helen Pearson, Chief Magazine Editor at Nature. Nature hardly needs introducing, being the premier journal of science. We're all used to hearing it cited, a study this week in the journal Nature. And Helen Pearson will also be known to very many of you as the author of The Life Project, her award-winning book about the remarkable data collected in Britain on birth cohorts. And Helen Pearson, as well, will be known to you as the excellent science journalist whose writing has been recognized by the Wistar Institute of Science and the Association of British Science Writers. And Helen Pearson will be known to you as the chief magazine editor of Nature, which brings us right to our topic for today's podcast. Scholarly Communication, this special series on the New Books Network, has the aim of showing just how research gets published, a podcast about how knowledge gets known. Everyone from first-year college students to tenured professors knows what research looks like because they either have been taught or have themselves taught how to do it. The same cannot be said about publishing. Scholarly Communication wants to help change that. Scholarly Communication wants to reveal to researchers and to readers alike just how essential communication is to their research. Because we believe that communication improves when people understand how communication happens. We believe, too, that research improves when researchers better understand their role as authors. A journal as vital to communication in the sciences as Nature, a journal as prestigious in the world of publishing as Nature, cannot be missed. Helen Pearson edits the news, the opinion, and more for Nature, and it is her workday, her preoccupations, and generally her perspective on research and publishing in particular, that make today's podcast. Helen, welcome to Scholarly Communication.
Thanks very much for having me on.
We'd like to begin with you and your typical workday. Could you maybe take us a bit on a short tour of what you find yourself doing day in, day out?
Sure. So, my role as chief magazine editor means that I oversee the journalism and opinion content for Nature. So while probably many people know Nature for, you know, the outstanding research and the primary research that we publish, we're also very unusual in actually being a science journal and a science magazine. So we also publish editorials, news, opinion content, careers content, analysis. And so all of that part of it falls under my remit. So I run quite a large team for Nature, between 60 and 70 people altogether who are producing all of that part of Nature. So when it comes to how I spend my day, I was thinking about this before I came on, what I'm actually doing today. I mean, a lot of it is making sure that team is working well, that they're all happy. You know, a lot of management is involved. And it's also thinking about the kind of high level, what Nature wants to be, what we want to do. So thinking about our editorial vision, our strategy, setting our course in terms of, you know, what editorial themes we might want to focus on this year, and our content strategy. So thinking about do we want to grow, for example, particular types of articles over others? So I'm doing a lot of that. I'm also, you know, reading content that's coming through, commenting on it, checking sensitive content, top editing content. So I probably do a less of actually having my hands on the words than I did perhaps earlier in my career, because I have a lot of outstanding editors in the team who can do that. And just, you know, thinking about this morning, is today a typical day? Well, none of it's typical, of course, anymore, because I'm working at home all the time. And we've all been doing that, of course, at Nature for the last 6 months or so. So that's our new normal. But so, for example, I dialed into our morning news meeting where we have all of our UK reporters and editors dial in, talk about what's been happening today. What do we need to cover? What have we already got coming through? I top edited an editorial. You know, I spent a lot of time with my news editor talking through, you know, the things to help her. So I suppose that's actually quite a typical morning. I hope that gives you a reasonable sense of what I'm up to.
Oh, it does, very much so, yeah. You talk about the unique position that Nature has, and it's true. I work at a university in writing support, and many of the journals that the people I'm teaching or helping, they're looking at are not journals that you would find necessarily on the newsstand, and yet Nature is one of those journals. And it's also considered to be the prime place to learn to land your research. Can you speak a bit more to this unique format that Nature has?
Sure. I mean, Nature is actually very rarely on newsstands nowadays. So our primary audience are our working scientists. That's who I'm thinking about all the time, is how to serve working scientists, working researchers around the world. And we know that those are our readers. Of course, you know, I mean, just by looking online at our analytics, we know we do bring in a much sort of bigger halo audience digitally than that. So we reach a lot of people who are just interested in science. And yeah, so I suppose your question is sort of, where does Nature sit within the sort of research ecosystem, the research publishing ecosystem? I think that we are, I mean, we're very aware that we are one, you know, player in this enormous and important research publishing industry. I mean, Nature is actually part of a you know, a bigger scientific and research publishing company, Springer Nature, which alone publishes over 3,000 journals. So, you know, we're one of many within, even within our own company. And I think we're more than aware of that. I think we ought to have a very modest view of where Nature sits. I mean, I know, you know, a Nature paper can count for a lot for many researchers, but publications in all journals and all types of research is extremely valuable, and we're more than aware of that. I suppose what do I think sets Nature apart? I mean, I do think it is quite unusual in having that format of, you know, trying to be this outstanding publisher of primary research and to be publishing the best in science news and commentary. And I quite like that as a kind of unique challenge for us, and hopefully a unique selling point. I think other things that set us apart is just being so multidisciplinary. So that is kind of amazing for me as a job, because you're just always encountering, you know, an amazing array of ideas across the disciplines. And I think that we all enjoy that. And that's part of what makes Nature special, is that very sort of broad remit. And I think, you know, another thing is international. So we have international in our strap line. So we're always thinking about, you know, for example, in news, if there's some development in research policy and we're going to write about that in our news section, we really want to make clear why that's of interest to an international audience rather than just a local one or a national one. And, you know, we're just always striving to have the kind of highest quality and authority in what we say. And I think there's a responsibility on us actually to do that, you know, given that we are Nature and the Nature name comes with something, then we have to be absolutely sure that we are right, for example, in the news that we report, and we take things like fact-checking extremely seriously. So that's, I suppose, from my perspective, some of the ways I view Nature as being, you know, interesting and different.
All right. Yeah, that's really interesting. And I like what you're saying there about how you vet the news obviously on the fact end, but how you also see if it's a fit for nature, if it's of interest to the scientists, if it reaches a broad enough public. Can you think of perhaps any story in the past, say, few months where interesting discussions arose around just these topics?
Well, I mean, there's really only been one story in the last few months because it's the pandemic.
Very much so, yeah.
I don't think I could talk about anything else in answer to that question. Well, I mean, that's been just such an interesting journey over the last, 6 months. I mean, we started reporting on it right back in January. I mean, it's kind of unusual in a way because, at Nature, we report on science news, and all of a sudden, everyone's reporting on this incredible and important science news story. So that has been, both good and bad. I mean, good because obviously it was really, really important that the world's media writes about this incredible event. And then just on a very sort of team level or for our particular outlet, then the challenge is, well, if we used to kind of think about how we could add value to stories and write about, in depth this important story, if everybody's doing that, then how do we continue to add something for our readers that still makes our coverage, stand out? So we actually ended up writing out some editorial kind of criteria in the way, in the end, that we were going to, as I said before, like always be focused on the research and the science. That's absolutely central to what we're covering. And we've always, been unafraid of going in deep on science. I mean, I think that's another selling point. We're not going to be shy about talking about the nitty gritty of the research process or, the discoveries. And we've absolutely committed to doing that. We were always, like many media outlets, just thinking about how we could add some value or add some analysis or add some context that would help all of these developments make sense. Because the other challenge is, we're not a huge news team or a huge operation. So, like many outlets, everybody's thinking about how they can still add something in this, evolving and very difficult situation. So, and I suppose the other thing is, just again, getting it right. I mean, given all of the, in this particular story, of course, the sort of proliferation of misinformation and disinformation, then again, there's this massive responsibility that we have to be sure about what we're saying. And so I think we really tried to double down on that.
That brings up a pretty interesting point beyond COVID-19 of misinformation, disinformation, and just the widespread availability of information. You've been in journalism perhaps some time and can say something to developments there. Would you say that now in 2020, vetting information and making sure that the story gets out right is done differently than it was done in the past?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I suppose I've been fortunate, and I've been at Nature a long time. So I joined Nature in 2001 as an online reporter, just to take a little segue into my career history. But those were the days when online news was probably considered to be secondary to the print issue. The print was what really mattered, and I don't think we would say that as much anymore. I mean, we get more readers now online than we ever do in print. But throughout all of that time, we've always had quite a rigorous fact-checking policy, and we have a rigorous sub-editing process, which is checking our facts and our sources. So I'm not sure there's been a huge change internally. I do think, externally, perhaps what we're up against has changed because, there's just so much more information out there, and it's become harder and harder for everyone to, including us, to filter what we should be listening to. And I think, sometimes I suppose we have debates if there's some new theory circulating. So do you, and I think this is interesting, that probably happens in lots of newsrooms. So do you take time to debunk something which has been falsely said elsewhere? Or do you spend time, given your limited resources, reporting on the actual facts and the actual news? And, you know, you can see this on other websites, right? I mean, sometimes there will be entire stories or efforts or, you know, even organizations setting up to fact checking what other people are saying. And I suppose we've felt so far, given that we do have limited resources, that we should focus on putting out high quality, accurate news and content rather than perhaps being distracted by an agenda which other people are setting. Now, you can argue whether that's right or wrong, because I think sometimes, you know, there is a responsibility to actually point out when something is wrong. And I suppose the times we do get into that is if there's some thing where if scientists are really reacting to something, that would be a kind of interesting story to us. And we would start to get into, you know, obviously, for example, about climate change. I mean, that's just a huge conversation which we need to be part of. And part of that would be talking about climate denialism and how that affects scientists' lives. So that would be an example in which, of course, we would be engaging with information which is potentially untrue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems to me to set a very clear strategy. If, in other words, if I'm accurately repeating what you've said here, then you'd be more or less relying on nature's established reputation of giving out the best of information, and on the other hand, looking to the scientific community to see what anything might be of interest beyond that, if it touches on society or politics or anything leaving the area of research. Would that be perhaps an encapsulation of the strategy you would say would be following in journalism?
Absolutely. I think that we are always trying to serve scientists in what we do. So we want to be, you know, invaluable and of use to them and helping, you know, science itself and scientists. Now, we've always covered areas where science, I suppose what I'm saying is it's not that we are ignoring, you know, society or politics. We will always cover those issues where they overlap with science and the lives of scientists. So that's absolutely part of what we do.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yes, yeah. I mean, that came up very clearly. Definitely, mm-hmm. Definitely. Mm-hmm. You mentioned different series that are brought in concerning careers, for example, because very many people looking to publish in Nature are in post-grad work, for example, in the laboratory and hoping to land a paper in Nature. Could you say something about some of those different series, for instance, pressure to publish or the PhD and other such career series that you've had?
Sure. I mean, we actually cover scientific careers and issues that matter to scientists, working scientists, all the time. So we have a dedicated careers section, which is extremely popular. So all type of careers issues, you know, issues that are important to the scientific community, PhDs, early career researchers, postdocs, you know, that's absolutely central to what we're doing. And interestingly, we know from online analytics that the people who are reading that content tend to skew a little bit younger, which is great because we really want to reach those early career researchers. So all of the things you've talked about, we cover regularly. In fact, we just published the first in a series where our careers team have done a survey of postdoctoral scientists. First time we've actually done that. I think we reached over about 6,000 and talking about the impacts on their lives of the pandemic, which of course are huge. in terms of potentially changing their career opportunities and making things difficult to them in terms of, mm-hmm. you know, going on in science. So, yeah, so I wouldn't say that's necessarily a kind of series. That's actually just sort of part of what we're doing all of the time, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. No, it's a standard section, so to speak, then.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm also interested, though, in how in the nitty-gritty, if you like, how this actually comes about. You've just talked about a very large team of upwards of 70 or 80 people that you're working with and that you're top editing different articles and so on. Could you, either through an example or generically, give us an idea of how, say, that most recent poll to PhD students or postdocs was done from start to finish?
Sure. So, yes, I mean, it really depends what type of article you're talking about, I suppose, because, I mean, the publication timescales will differ absolutely drastically depending on what we're talking about. So, for example, with a news story, we might be discussing it today and publishing it tomorrow. But with a more substantial project, let's say, like the postdoc survey, you know, we were discussing that a year ago because it would obviously take a huge amount of planning and so forth. So what's most useful to talk to you about? I mean, I could give you talk about a news story, or I could talk about a feature, or
I think probably not the news story, unless you had an inclination for that. But maybe a feature, or even this most recent.
I can probably talk best about features, because before I was doing this job, then at Nature, I ran the features team, so I was really involved in the nitty gritty of that. The news features are our sort of longest, our long form journalistic articles. So they might run across, you know, between 2-4 up to maybe 5 pages in a print issue. So maybe 2,400, 3,200 words. And they would probably be anywhere between, I don't know, I mean, as little as a month in the making, because we've really speeded them up, especially during the pandemic, actually, to, again, as much as a year, depending on what the idea is. And I would say probably about half are reported by our staff reporters. So we have a team of journalists who work within Nature, and we also work very closely with fantastic freelance writers who work around the world. And sometimes ideas are pitched to us, and sometimes we will, quite often, you know, editors within their discussions will come up with an idea that we think is a fantastic news feature and just really deserves, you know, more depth, more words, more reporting than you would want from a news story. And then we would commission it, and a reporter for a news feature. I mean, again, it could be, you know, with COVID, we've really sped things up sometimes, because the whole news pace has just been moving so quickly. You know, you can have an idea today, and tomorrow you'll see 3 other people publish that idea or that article. So you have to be quick. You know, we've done them in as little as 2 weeks, but before COVID, you know, it would probably be a lot longer than that, because a journalist might go away and have to make, you know, 20 phone calls, 30, you know, to interview scientists and bring it all together. And then once they submit a draft, then an editor would be working with them very closely. If it was me, you know, this is really quite nitty gritty, but, you know, I would probably be going through that piece in great detail, adding a large number of comments, questions, sending it back to the journalist to say, can you adjust it? Can you do me a second draft? It would come back to me as an editor. At that point, I would usually do a line edit where you actually, you know, are going through it line by line, word by word, making sure it's moving things around, adjusting it, editing it. And then there would be further back and forth with the reporter until you were happy with it. And then alongside that, we would be having, we work very, very closely with our art team at Nature to work out what graphics do we want to show, because we know that graphics, I mean, we just, I'm really, really proud of the graphics that we do, and the art team does an amazing job, but we also know that readers really like them. So we're often thinking about what, you know, data can we display, what can we show, what's the best way to illustrate that point, what photography might we want to use. And then alongside that, at some point, the text would go over to our sub-editors, who would go through it extremely carefully for grammar, for style, for sensitivities, for fact-checking. And after all that has happened, then we would be getting close to publishing it. And often it will publish in digital before it would ever go into the print issue. I mean, that's almost always the case now. So that, in a nutshell, is what it takes to just produce one article.
Yes, yes. That somehow doesn't surprise me, writing being always a process and a team effort in that way. Do you have any of these ideas coming down the line that get started, that enter the editing process and at some point get sidelined or even left?
We're actually quite good at nature at not doing that. I mean, that's sort of called killing a piece, I suppose. We're quite rigorous in the way that we probe an idea before we would commission it, because, you know, nobody wants to waste their time working really hard on an article which won't eventually be published. So we're far more likely to really make sure that it's something that we think will work before we would commission it, if this is a piece from a reporter. I mean, sometimes, of course, events change. You know, you're always reacting in news. So, yes, sometimes you have to recast a piece or think, you know, I mean, there's often ways you can keep the body of the text, but you might need to just reframe it or something if events have changed. So I think generally that's more likely what we would do than actually completely give up on a story.
I see. Okay. All right. You mentioned also then it being published digital before it then enters into the print format. There, would you say a large difference in content between the two? Are there many features online that you're not finding in the print, or perhaps even the other way around?
I mean, that's a great question. So we've sort of increasingly over the last sort of 5 years probably just pushed more and more towards this whole digital first way of thinking, which of course has happened across media organizations, you know, particularly ones which have a long, long legacy of print like we do. But, you know, you need to go where the readers are and serve readers, and they are on their laptops and their phones, and that's where we need to be. I would say in terms of you're basically saying how much more content have we got online than ends up being going into the print issue. In news, I'd say there's a reasonable amount. There's some that we would only appear online and we wouldn't put it into print. But with most of the other sections, I would say, and by sections, I mean the other kind of article types, I would say most of what we're publishing digitally is ending up in the print issue. But it's just, it might not be, you know, immediately after it's published in digital. So there might be more of a lag than we would have had in the past. And we're just sort of increasingly moving to this concept of, you know, curating the kind of the best of what we published in digital into the print issue, which again is sort of, you know, the way that the industry is going.
Okay, yeah. So no major exception there in comparison to other
no,
online and
so.
Print. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. You mentioned earlier the analytics and said that you are able to see that, for instance, many of your career's features are extremely popular. Could you perhaps point to other features that rank in a similar way?
Sure. I mean, maybe I should just talk a bit about sort of how do we gauge whether what we're doing is a success, right?
That's a better question.
Because analytics is, you know, one way of looking at that. And what's interesting is that sometimes, you know, we're going to publish a piece which we know is really important editorially, and it sort of speaks to our editorial mission or our mission statement. And I can come back to that if you want. But we actually know that piece might not do very well online, but that's obviously not going to stop us publishing it. So I suppose there's that. So there's one way of is sort of, are we've set ourselves some editorial goals. Maybe we've said, you know, we are focusing, for example, we've had a push to really focus on climate change, you know, so it fulfills that goal. We really want to cover climate change. So that's a success in one way. But we can also, of course, look at analytics and, you know, and kind of understand reader behavior in a way that we can never do with the print issue, because although you can count how many print issues that people that we're sending out, we don't actually know without doing surveys, which we do sometimes do. But you don't know really week to week what articles have resonated with readers. And that's what you can do with analytics online. So we do look at that. And I have a fantastic person, Anna Nagel, in my team, who looks carefully at our traffic all the time and is feeding that back to the team so that we can make, you know, use that to inform our editorial strategy. So we're looking at kind of total page views that we get on pieces. We look at page views we're getting from academic institutions, from subscribing institutions, which give us a really a sort of more focused way of understanding what actually the working scientists are reading. And that can be actually sometimes quite different to what the sort of broader audience is looking at. And then we're also looking at other measures of impact. So we look, we really want to be publishing what we would term thought leadership. So, you know, we want to be setting the agenda in science. We want to be shaping how it's done. We want to be improving science. And so we are trying as best we can to work out whether we have done that. And that is much harder to gauge because you're trying to measure whether you've made a difference in the real world. And I think lots of media organizations sort of struggle with how to actually measure that. But for example, we would look at things like, you know, how much discussion have we prompted on social media? Has there been media pickup of, for example, a piece about science policy that we published? Have we won journalism awards or design awards? And sometimes we get active feedback actually from either authors that we've published or elsewhere that says, you know, this piece really made a difference and this has led to such and such a white paper or this has caused this change of policy. And we actually try and log that impact in what we call our impact tracker, which we're trying to improve at the moment, but a kind of way of saying, you know, how much real world kind of impact have you had with that journalism or opinion content? So lots of different ways, really. You know, that it's unsurprisingly, there's no simple answer to kind of what success is.
No, it doesn't surprise at all. I just wanted to follow up there on that last point that you made about getting feedback from scientists or authors saying that it led to perhaps this white paper or definitely influenced discussion in one way or the other. That seems to be really the, I don't want to say most relevant, but certainly very weighty feedback, because if I'm understanding your mission correctly, it is to enter into and also to lead a bit of the scientific community's conversation, if you like. So would that sort of feedback really impress the team?
We're always delighted. Yeah, absolutely it would. And we're always delighted to hear from people that we've worked with and also where we've made a difference. I mean, sometimes we get sort of more feedback just around the editing process, because I think sometimes it's not appreciated how much, you know, actual hands-on editing is going into producing, for example, a piece of opinion content, which might have been written by an expert author, but we're really going to work with them, you know, hand by hand, hand in hand to shape that piece and bring out the message and make it, you know, really sing. And so we actually get quite a lot of nice feedback about you know, just that editing process, sort of adding value there. And then we also get this sort of feedback around, and then did that piece go on and make a difference in the world? And so, yes, I mean, that's really important to the team. And we actually, I mean, one of the projects we've been really excited about the last couple of years, which we're in at the moment, is we won some funding from the Google Digital News Innovation Fund, which is a Google fund, which is trying to further all kinds of different projects around digital journalism. And ours is to build a impact tracker, so a kind of tool by which when we learn about that type of impact, real world impact, we can actually input it into a database and then sort it and potentially produce reports out of it. So that's the kind of ongoing project that we're in at the moment, which I think will be really exciting when we get to the end of it.
Yes, well, it does sound very exciting. I'd like to follow up again on something there with the editing process, because what you said there about getting feedback from authors and being appreciative of the changes that were made to their texts, or the kind of work that goes on your end to, as you say, honing their message, making it sing, I think is the word you even used. The actual writing bit is what I'm interested now, I suppose, to put it quite simply. Questions of style, questions of, let's say, differing communicative abilities. Not every great scientist is a great writer. Not every great scientist has English as their first language. Could you speak to that area of editing?
Sure. I mean, you know, one thing for Nature is we are really committed to publishing a diversity of voices, and we're really working hard to diversify the authors that we work with. And absolutely, we, you know, copy will come in all kinds of different states. I mean, you know, you know this, someone who
I do.
teaches science writing, but some people can dash something off and it's absolutely beautiful. And, you know, you can, as an editor, almost wave it through to press, and other pieces are going to, you know, involve an enormous amount of rewriting. And you know, potentially re-reporting and so forth. So, but that's what editors do. And, you know, that could be really enjoyable as well, to take something and actually really sort of help an author extract the message and sort of distill the message that they want to say. So, yeah, I mean, of course, sometimes it's a challenge, and it's not, I can't suggest that everybody's writing into us saying, we loved what you did, because some, you know, I mean, I've been edited myself, and it's still really hard, right? It's always hard to have someone come in and change what you were trying to say. So it's a bit painful, but we normally end up with something which is better in the end.
Is there any way that you could perhaps put a name or two, or a point or two, on some of the guidelines that are in editors' minds when they're shaping something for the Nature page? Let's stay very much, of course, in your area of the journalism and opinion. But when something's coming in, even from a freelancer, or let's say it's from a scientist, how do you make a judgment on, even on the level of the sentence, if you like, or on word choice, that says this is now communicating, this is now getting through?
Well, I mean, in terms of, yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, you've got to have something at the core of it, I think, which is something original and fresh that the author wants to say. Right, because otherwise it doesn't really matter how many words you wrap around it, but there's no particular point publishing it. So that would be the first thing. I think that you just want things to be clear, I think. I mean, if ever I'm editing something and it's just a bit hard to quite work out, you know, what the sentence is saying, then we need to have another look at it. So it just has to be clear. I mean, you want people to just be able to read straight through it. It's just got to be a straightforward, enjoyable experience that you can understand, not that you're struggling to understand or that it makes you feel stupid because you can't understand it. And I think, interestingly, I'm sure you find this as well, but as an editor, that you feel very free to ask stupid questions, right? Because if you don't understand it as the editor, then probably your readers won't understand it either. So it's okay to just say, no, I can't quite see what you're trying to say with this. You know, tell me again what you're trying to say. So, you know, clarity is absolutely paramount. We don't really tolerate too much jargon, I think, in our journalism and opinion. You know, we're really trying to, I mean, if you look, obviously it's a research paper, just because of the way that the research community now is so specialized, then most papers are very inaccessible to people who are outside that field. But what we are always thinking about for a piece in the front of Nature, in the magazine part, is that piece readable and understandable by anyone in any discipline? And so I think that's quite a useful way to think about it. So a level of jargon which would be acceptable in a research paper is probably not acceptable in a piece that we would be writing about. And I suppose the other thing, you know, we do try and, I mean, we're always thinking about the kind of the data and the evidence to support what we're saying. And so often we are pushing to, you know, if somebody wants to make a provocative statement in an opinion piece, then we want to know how that is supported. And so the more data we can have behind something, then the better, as far as we're concerned.
Okay, yeah, well, that gives a very clear picture, and it also reflects the idea, as you said in the very beginning, that your readership is interdisciplinary, so you want to make sure that the upfront content, as you say, is for everyone, and perhaps after that, the actual research articles are certainly going to be slightly more pinpointed, if you like,
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, all right. One last thing that I'd be interested in is... you talked about a mission statement in your editing, and you said that you might be able to flesh that out a bit and tell us a bit more about what its content is, if you would, that would be very interesting.
Yes, I mean, our mission statement is published online, so it's certainly no secret. I probably should have done this at the start because it allows me to talk a little bit actually about the history of nature, which is quite interesting. And we all spent a lot of time thinking about this last year because nature was founded in 1869, so we were 150 last year. So we had various celebrations and the celebratory anniversary issue. But anyway, it's the reason this is relevant to the mission statement is our mission statement has not changed all that much since the very start. And the mission statement now shows that part of our mission is not just publishing primary research. It's always been about this wider communication of research. And if you Google Nature mission statement, you can find it. But it says that so our mission statement is first to serve scientists through prompt publication of significant advances in any branch of science, and to provide a forum for the reporting and discussion of news and issues concerning science. And second, to ensure that the results of science are rapidly disseminated to the public throughout the world in a fashion that conveys their significance for knowledge, culture, and daily life. And, you know, that really kind of shows, as I said, this this dual purpose that we have, that this news side of nature is actually fundamental to what we're doing, not just a kind of add-on. And interestingly, actually, right back at the very start when Nature was founded, it was actually founded more as a popular science magazine, so perhaps more like Scientific American or New Scientist Today. And it was actually only over time that it became, it evolved into a journal that in which scientists published primary research. And so we kind of, I mean, that, you know, again, sort of shapes. It's not so specific, obviously, that it's guiding us into saying, well, we need to cover climate change, but it does just show that the activities of what, you know, I and my team do is really a very important part of what Nature does by fulfilling its mission. And, you know, there was one stat I just wanted to throw in, actually, which is about 70% of the articles we publish, if you just go by count, are journalism and opinion content, which just goes to show what a big part of the journal it actually is.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Interesting history too, as well. The fact that it's kept this character of having, as you say, this news dissemination idea, but also become so important to primary research as well.
That's right.
One thing we've kind of overlooked in our interview because of me, I failed to ask you a bit about yourself and your career background. If you could maybe, you did mention in passing that you entered in 2001, I believe, into Nature. Could you give us a brief trajectory, if you like, what brought you to science journalism?
Sure, yes. So I was in scientific research myself just up to the end of a PhD, which I did up at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. And after that, I had a sense that, you know, while I loved science, I didn't necessarily enjoy the intense focus on one narrow area, which, of course, you experience in a PhD. And I think if you speak to lots of science journalists, they often tell the same thing, that they wanted a kind of broader view. And so I went from that. I worked briefly in the Science Museum in London. I started to do a bit of freelance science writing for New Scientist. And then I was able to get a position at Nature, as you said, in 2001 as an online reporter. So I was reporting and really editing for Nature from that point on. I spent 8 years of that in New York, which was a great experience, working in our New York office and just getting a sort of sense of, you know, US research and policy, which I think is fantastic and to have. And now I am back in London. And I mentioned before that, you know, within that path, I was focused for a while on features editing and running the features team, which is kind of, I suppose, my personal love, perhaps in longer form science writing and science journalism. I really enjoy that, and that led on eventually to writing the book. So that's really been my path, I'd say.
Yeah, yeah. And the feature writing is certainly what captures my attention. I'm completely on board with you there. One quick question there to the your experience in America. You mentioned that it was quite interesting to see how policy was. Could you say a word to how it's what it is that you learned there, maybe, in that direction?
Well, I think it's just, I mean, it's always useful to live in another country, isn't it? Because it broadens your horizons. But particularly if you're going to live in a sort of scientific superpower, then that's quite useful when it comes to being in the business that I'm in. I just had to report. I mean, I was mostly writing about biomedical research, but obviously starting to understand how important institutions such as the National Institutes of Health, you know, work and how research funding is given out and, you know, the intense competition, I think, for funding and to publish. So I think just a sort of general education in seeing how that research community operates is incredibly useful. And, you know, of course, we're covering that all the time. So it helps shape what we're wanting to write about. And we do have a very significant audience in the US. So I think about half of our readers in general are from the US. So we certainly want to cover those issues.
Okay, well, Helen, you've been very generous with your time with us. And I'd like to just close off with one last question. If you could speak to any current project that you're doing inside or outside of nature.
Absolutely. I've got a project inside and a project outside nature. I mean, inside nature, the ongoing project is how to continue to cover the pandemic, which is absolutely, you know, obviously the biggest story of the year. It's just been an unprecedented year in so many ways. I feel like that term's been overused this year, and I've used it. But thinking about how we continue to add value to that, as you know, it's been interesting to see the kind of news agenda broaden in other outlets, and we can actually, you know, stay completely focused on the research and the science of the pandemic. So we're thinking about that, and even, you know, starting to think, well, how do we represent this year actually? Because we're still already planning our end of year content. You know, how do we summarize a year like that for our readers in a useful way? So that's what we're thinking about within nature, and already started to think about our coverage for 2021. And then outside nature, I'm just starting to work on a second book, which is about the use of evidence in multiple different disciplines and how we use it to make decisions. So I've got something else to keep me busy as well. So, you know, not too much going on.
Yeah, well, that's an understatement. And in true British fashion. Well, the book sounds fascinating, and perhaps at some future date, when it's completed and successful, we can talk about it here
on
Scholarly Communication. Great. Well, thank you very much. That is Helen Pearson, Chief Magazine Editor at Nature. I'm Daniel Shea, and this is goodbye from me to Helen. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Thanks for having me on the show.
And this is goodbye to everyone else. Until next time, bye-bye.